So if you're missing football, here's an answer. I don't have the answer, but Brian Barwick has. Now, here's a man who is steeped in the national game. His latest book is called 60 Years of the World Cup. It's personal reflections of the world's greatest festival of football. It's out now, published by Pitch. I spoke with Brian recently. I asked him, first of all, why he wanted to write it.
I chose to write it because 2 years ago I wrote a book called 60 Years of Red and Counting, which was a 60-year odyssey saga of Liverpool Football Club. I went to see their first game in October 1961. This was 2021. And I did a sort of essay on each season from the perspective of the club, where I was in life, and where we occasionally linked up, which towards the end was a lot of times. Anyway, the publishers were very pleased with it and said, did I have any other ideas? And I just thought, well, hold on, 2022, the World Cup, 62 was the first one I remember as an eight-year-old watching a bit of black and white television. So I put that to them, and they were really up for it. And I really enjoyed doing it. And in fact, I was very proud of the Liverpool book. I think I'm even prouder of this one because it's just a broader canvas to work to and on.
Well, the national events, some of these games, some of these tournaments, and we'll come on to that in a moment, but the one thing that glows from every page is how much of a fan of the England team you are.
Yeah, I'm a football fan. You know, it's just ingrained in me from an early age. It's been something that I've, in the end, had a lot of fun with through broadcasting, through working in football, but also, most importantly, going to see it and going to watch it. And certainly the World Cups. A lot of people who've seen and read this book have really enjoyed it, it seems. And one of the things that all's almost commonality is they always remember the first World Cup they watched.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's almost like a marker in the ground of when you join the football family. And I think that's really true. And I think because I was blessed to be alive and kicking and 12 years of age when the 66 World Cup came to England and in Merseyside where I lived, that really did cement a long life of affection for the tournament. And that's the other thing I've tried to do in the book. It's nostalgic, it's affectionate, and it's fun. It's a bit of a romp on occasions, and that's what I wanted it to be. Because football for me is great fun. It's great fun.
How much did you recall of 66? And how much, when you were doing research for this, did it surprise you that maybe the things you'd misremembered or forgotten?
Actually, 66, you've got to remember, it was a smaller tournament, 16 teams. So, and there was a game on every night, black and white television, one night BBC, the other night next night ITV. And, you know, the games weren't spread out. For example, the quarterfinals of the World Cup, the main one that was broadcast on both ITV and BBC at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, was England-Argentina. But the other three games kicked off at 3 o'clock that same day and weren't broadcast on British television live. You know, so
it's amazing, really. I loved a previous book you wrote. I think it's called "Are You Watching the Match Tonight?" And because you've been at the heart of the nation's game to the masses on TV throughout that story. And looking back, say 30 years to the 90s, FA Cup semi-finals played at the same time. There'd be a scarcity of live football for fans to watch, wouldn't there?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons the FA Cup final kept its status for so long, it was the only club game that was broadcast live throughout the whole of a football season. And of course, the semi-finals of the FA Cup were not shown live until 1990, other than the replay of the Hillsborough game at Old Trafford, I think it was. So one of the reasons the games moved and were live because of that tragedy and making sure as many people could see the game safely as possible, both at the stadiums and on the broadcast.
This is your love affair with a sport down the generations, and it's so true what you say about if you're at that, it's like a Venn diagram, isn't it? If you're at a proper age, your first World Cup. For me, it was España 82. And you were right at the heart of that tournament.
Yeah, I just joined the BBC. And I'd been there about 2 years, and they were allocating the squad to do the work over in Spain. And I was given a role as the second producer, can carrier, for England. And I thought, that's great. And then the guy that was supposed to be looking after Northern Ireland for the BBC went over to ITV, which was a criminal offence in those days. And so I got given Northern Ireland, which I consider to be a promotion and relegation in the same sentence, because I wasn't going to do in England. However, Northern Ireland turned into be one of the stories of the tournament, not least because they beat the host Spain in Valencia. It was a major, and qualified for the second set of group games, because there were no quarterfinals then. It was a second group stage. I felt lucky. I felt really lucky with that, because they became one of the stories of the World Cup. And I ended up, bizarrely, in the official FIFA film, Goalie. I didn't realise I was
with the red cap on.
I went to the cinema and watched it.
Yeah.
And they made quite a fuss of that in feature inside that film. And one of the bits was Billy Bingham, the manager, and Jerry Armstrong running across the pitch and me following them. Because I was told by my BBC bosses, make sure you get the interviews at the end of the game and make sure you're wearing something we can spot. So I had a bright red cap on. So, sure enough, I'm in that movie. And whenever it's on and my boys see it, I have to go behind the settee. A lot slimmer, by the way, then, as well.
Which radio, we can't tell. We think you look the same, svelte like Adonis.
Absolutely, yeah. That'll do for me. Yeah. That'll do for me.
And even the final at the Bernabeu, there's a lovely picture of you as a fan. Yeah, working, but as a fan, there going to the World Cup final. And I think you had an interesting evening as well, didn't you, after the game?
Well, I was... The idea with the BBC at the time was if whatever team you are working with, if they go home, you go home. But for some reason, they allowed me to stay on just to keep busy, really. And two things fell out of that, really. Firstly, I ended up travelling around a lot with Bobby Charlton. And Bobby Charlton knocked on my hotel door one evening and said, Brian, I've been invited by the Rolling Stones manager. They're playing the Atletico Madrid Stadium. Do you fancy coming? So I said, why not? So the both of us went, saw the concert, and went backstage and met the chaps. And I wrote it on a postcard to my mother the following day. I said, Mom, things going okay here. Things going very okay. I went to see the Rolling Stones and met them actually after the concert, because I went with Bobby Charlton. And in the end, I couldn't send that postcard because it sounded ridiculous. But on the day of the final, I was ushered into the BBC boss who was running it then, who had given me one or two tellings off for being over enthusiastic during the tournament. He said, I've got something for you, and another volley. But it was a ticket for the final.
Wow.
And then I went back to the hotel, and our hotel happened to be the hotel where the Italians were staying. And it was bombarded, as you can imagine, by the Italian media. But I was allowed in because I had a room there. And we were all pushing and shoving. Eventually, I got pushed into this salon, as they'd call it, hall. And I was in the Italian team's celebrations.
And we move from Dermot Kennedy back to Brian Barwick. He's the star of the big evening interview this night. He is a man steeped in football. It has shaped his career. He's helped shape the national game as well. His latest book is out now. It's published by Pitch. It's called 60 Years of the World Cup, a series of personal reflections on the world's greatest game, seen via the prism of the world's greatest tournament. So, as we continued our chat, I asked him, which has been his favourite World Cup?
I think one of my favourites, well, let's say 66 was remarkable, but when you're 12 years of age and go to see Brazil, Portugal, Pelé, Eusebio, has stayed with me all my life, as has the Charity Shield two or three weeks later when Roger Hunt and Ray Wilson ran around with the World Cup at Goodison Park. I think Italia 90 takes some beating as an event. For all sorts of reasons. Televisually, I was in charge of the BBC's coverage of that World Cup. If you remember, the back end of the 80s had been tough. Tragedy at Hillsborough, tragedy at Bradford, and also Heysel, the disgrace of Heysel, and just hooliganism. And we managed to find a way of elevating that tournament, not least through picking Pavarotti's Nessun Dorma, which suddenly gave the thing a real sense of class. And England did well, you know, semi-finals. And many of the big games happened at the weekends in peak time, which is always a good thing for television. So whilst we didn't win it, it definitely changed, I think. It was absolutely a seminal World Cup in terms of changing the aspect of what people thought about football. And it helped it lift off again. Of course, within 2 years, the Premier League started. And also within 2 years, Classic FM started, because people in the radio business listened to Nessun Dorma, thought there's something in this, you know. And sure enough, they started a channel which I believe is still alive and well. And for us, it was a marvellous sort of something that is still talked about. You know, 4 years later, Des Lynam and I were invited to the on the eve of the final to the Los Angeles Dodgers Stadium to see Pavarotti and the three tenors reprising what they did in Rome. And we were about four rows from the front. In fact, we kept going past Hollywood A-listers, thinking at some stage somebody's going to stop us. But they didn't. And then we got about four rows from the front. We noticed a load of people were walking past the front row and staring at a couple of these guys on the front row. So we joined them. And it was Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly.
Wow.
So, I mean, we were really in and amongst
that tops the Rolling Stones, doesn't it, that?
So they're the sort of bizarre thing, the byproducts of some of the stuff I've been involved in, yeah. 90 was really important, I think. I do think it was Big Jack Charlton, it was Bobby Robson, it was Pavarotti. And about 2 years ago, I got a phone call from Los Angeles. I didn't know it was Los Angeles at the time, and it was a lady in a strong American accent saying, "I'm driving down the freeway and I'm talking to you on my cell phone." And I thought, "No, who's this wind up?" And anyway, she eventually gave me her name and said they were doing a documentary on Pavarotti, and the great Ron Howard.
Oh yeah,
was,
Happy Days. Director.
Yeah, was directing it. He'd done a great one on the Beatles about 2 years before, and my name had come up. And could they fly over to Britain and interview me and a couple of other people about choosing Nessun Dorma? So, okay. So, although I have to say I'm one of five people who say they chose it. You know, that's
classy though. Classy, wasn't it? Just elevated it, didn't it?
I'm well happy to be in the five.
Yeah, so
they did fly over and they said, "We're going to hold this interview in Teddington, so we'll get you a limousine to..." I didn't tell them. I live about three quarters of a mile from that place. So I thought, I'll have the limousine.
A limo's a limo, isn't it?
And it was straight into hair and makeup. Now, this is radio, but if you could see me, you'd realise I only needed makeup. I eventually did the interview, and it did hit the cutting room floor, but I got a very nice letter from Ron Howe saying that I'd informed the project very enormously, which is a very nice way of saying we didn't want you in the movie.
Listen, I could talk with you all night. I know you're busy. Oh, even though it's the close season, so I don't know what we do with ourselves. I suppose it's the Ashes, isn't it? We must turn our attention to now.
I'm up for watching a bit of that, yeah.
But what a book. I really enjoyed it. And as I say, these touchstones, as we measure out our lives in these World Cups every 4 years, it was brilliant hearing your stories and triggering off some of my own. So, Brian, thank you so much for having a chat with us.
It's been a delight, and thank you very much for asking me.
As you can hear from the anecdotes there, well worth a read. It's by Brian Barwick. He's the star of the big evening interview tonight. It's called 60 Years of the World Cup, and it's out now.